You know, sometimes in the summer, I always think it's a really good time to talk a little bit about John Wesley, because sometimes people might come to church and not even know what it means to be a Methodist. In fact, most people if I talk to maybe don't know a whole lot about John Wesley. But I was thinking about John Wesley this week, because I was thinking, you know how they're starting to have the presidential election stuff? Yeah, you love it, don't you? And I got... And I got to thinking, it won't be long, we'll hear all those speeches again, right? Have you noticed, though, when they have those speeches, they usually have, what, just a few people, or they'll have a few hundred, you know? Did you know that back in the 18th century, there actually were a couple of guys who were talking about change for the better, and that's what all the political people talk about, right? Time for change. And they had 20 to 30,000 people show up. Can you imagine that? Well, those persons were George Whitefield and was John Wesley. And they would attract about 20 to 30,000 people, and they would call people to make a change, saying things like, come ye poor, lost, and weary, and, you know, sinners, you know, come to, just as you are to Christ. Come just as you are. I think Trevor's going to sing a little bit about that later, right? And within a few years, John Wesley was also preaching with George Whitefield, and he was preaching to thousands of people about a change of heart, not a change of the political process, right? Now, Whitefield and Wesley disagreed on one point. Whitefield thought that if you were saved, you were saved. And John Wesley said, I think there's a need for something more after that. He said, I think that they new converts come with this desire to change, but if you don't give them something to keep that initial fire up, you know what it's like when you feel it in your belly and you feel you got God there, that if there's not something following it up, it kind of what? Dies out, doesn't it? Becomes the same old same, all right? So John Wesley would have revivals, and he'd say this revival is just like starting a fire. This initial blaze is burning pretty bright, right? But what happens if we don't feed that fire? The camping people know, right? Eventually, it'll go out and the bugs will get you. I know how that works. So Wesley called for something more. And I can understand what Wesley was talking about, because have you ever experienced maybe a worship service that you really felt touched your heart? Or maybe you're watching one of those commercials on TV, you know, where they're talking about the children in a foreign land. Or it could be the dogs, the dog ones. They get me every time. I don't know what it is. Hallmark commercials I cry at, you know. But something just really touches your spirit, you know. And maybe it makes you jump forward in your faith, you know. It's a big aha moment, you know. You move forward in your faith. Or maybe you had a personal crisis. I think most of us have had that, where a friend is sick, or you're sick, or somebody passes away, or it could be you lose a job, or you have an economic problem, you know, and you have this crisis of faith, and you just know that Jesus has come and helped you get through that moment. Or it could be like Dwayne, who did die and came back, right? That's a really faith crisis, I would say, yeah, you know, to have it. But at the same time, even though that happens, eventually, it's same old, same old. And I think that faith can be really fragile, you know? It's easy for it to break and not to be there anymore. And Wesley thought that, too. And interestingly enough, Wesley was, of course, at the Church of England, in England, as you probably all know, right? And the Church of England was, at that time, really close to how we see the church in the United States now. As you know, we've got declining members. Some of the churches are kind of in disarray, right? Church attendance was an all-time low. Church attendance has been going down since 1950, all right? So it's down as well. Many of the people at that time in England didn't even bother to go to church. They didn't think they needed it anymore. They didn't know anything about the Bible. They knew very little about God. You know, they were still interested in spirituality. Does it sound a little familiar to maybe what's going on right now? The nation, though, of England at that time was in total disarray, you know. The poor were the largest part of the population, and they were working in dangerous coal mines, and they were in depressing warehouses working in London, and they lived in this really deep, deep poverty. As you can tell, the divide between the rich and the poor was just huge in England at that time, right? And the very fabric the very fabric, you know, of the nation was just being shredded to pieces. Historians in England and have credited really one man, John Wesley, and the United Methodist preachers for not only reviving the Christian faith in England, in Scotland, in Wales, and in America, but they really believe they saved England themselves. Is that hard to believe? That faith could have such strength that could save a nation? So he saved it both politically by saving it spiritually. Wesley realized that his Methodists needed something, simple guide for living their Christian faith, you know, in the in-between times between worship, and then, of course, he had society meetings. As you all know, he had his small groups, and the small group would meet every week, and they'd be accountable to each other to say, what did you do for works of mercy, which was out helping other people, right, doing something? What'd you do for works of piety? And that would be your prayer and your meditation, your scripture reading, right? And he said, well, I need a general rule, something really simple, like a slogan, like pop, pop, fizz, fizz, oh, what a relief it is, or one of those, right? I'm sure there's others, you know, that you could come up with that we hear on Away Goes Trouble Down the Drain. We know that one, right? There's a few that we hear on TV all the time that we kind of know, right? And he says, we need one of those catchy slogans. Maybe it wasn't that catchy. It was, do no harm, do good, and stay in love with God. John Wesley would often say that. For our spiritual growth, it's like moving into a house. Our first step of faith is like we're stepping on the porch to this house. And then God opens the door to the house for us to come in. And that's by grace that we receive, right? But when we move into a house, when you move into a house, do you just stay right where you came in? You don't, right? So spiritual growth was about moving into different sections of the house. For example, you need to go to the kitchen, right? Because what do you get in the kitchen? Food, sustenance, something to grow your faith, right? And then at some time you need to go to the bedroom because what do you need? Sleep, relaxation, right? There's a time to go to the study because in the study of the house, you're going to learn more about your faith, learn more about God and spiritual growth, right? So there are three simple rules help us move through this house. Do no harm, do good, and stay in love with God. What are they? I think you can tell me. They're up on the screen. Do you find it interesting that Wesley didn't start with do good? He started with do no harm. And I thought, that sounds like the Hippocratic Oath, doesn't it? You know, why not start with do good? We all get that pretty well, right? Because Wesley believed that while we are created in the image of God, without grace of God, we've been deformed by sin, right? We like to put ourselves first before we put others. And a result of that, like we saw this morning in the drama, we cause harm to other people. The author of Genesis tells us that we were made in God's image. We were created to live in right relationships. Those relationships of love with God, with who else? Others, yes. And who else? Creation, right. And God threw in there to love ourselves, right? Sometimes we forget that part of it, don't we, right? However, we decided we didn't want it God's way. We wanted the Burger King's way, have it our way, you know. And then if we need God, then we'll ask God about that choice, right? And when that happened, we even stopped taking the blame for our own mistakes. As you remember, they started pointing fingers at each other in the garden, and we've been doing that ever since. And then what happened to the serpent? What did they do to the serpent in the garden? You don't know. Next week, we will be studying Genesis. They smashed the head of the serpent. And that's when I think we started not caring for the earth and not caring for the animals and the creature here, you know. And we started using up the resources of the earth, and we weren't doing good things for the ecology. We have definitely broken the relationship not only with fellow humans and with God, but with creatures and with the earth. So God created a world where everything was right. Everyone loved each other. Can you imagine that? Living in a world where everything was right. Right relationships everywhere. You never had to worry about this gossip. Anybody ever been hurt by gossip before? Right? We didn't have to worry about that. You think we live in right relationships anymore? I don't even think we're capable of having one right relationship anymore because of what sin has done to us. And so clearly we have a choice of whether to choose things that grow us closer to God, or we can choose for ourselves and choose things that get us far away from God. But when we try to choose ourselves first and we take our things and we don't make God center of our life, that's a sin. And when we make something else like wealth, or maybe it's power or sex or alcohol, the center of our life, that's adultery and that's sin, right? Without God at the center of our life, you know what? We will never, never have right relationships because we don't know how to do that. What we will have is bickering and fighting and hatred and cruelty and violence and greed and arrogance, all those things that we see in the world today. I think we have the capacity to do a lot of harm in our lives. And you know what is really bad? For some people, the deepest harms they've ever felt has come from the church, have come from people in the church who you expected to love you, but didn't. So what does do no harm mean? Well, ultimately, I think it means that we think about everything that we do. It's thoughtful consideration to our actions way before we do them. Before we do them to ourselves, before we do them to somebody else. It means we don't cause physical harms. What are some of the ways we can do physical harm to other people? We can hit them, you're right. We can punch them, we could bite them. I've seen kids do that. We can shake, we can kick, we can, you know, and that certainly includes domestic violence, which we pretend doesn't exist in the church. It exists in the church, right? It also means we don't let other people do harm to us because we care about ourselves, and so we don't do addictive practices, right? Or we don't take unnecessary physical risks with our lives, you know, to see how fast a car will go and hope we can stop it, right? Or play chicken with another car, which I know people, when I was growing up, used to do that, right? And then there's psychological harm. I think we do lots of psychological harm when you think about it. Humiliating somebody else? Intimidating somebody else so that they'll obey us, yelling or threatening or bullying, or constantly criticizing each other. A lot of people don't look at it that way, but that is psychological harm, you know? I got to thinking, how many people here could truthfully say that they have never been guilty of gossip, have never been guilty of humiliating somebody else or criticizing somebody else or brought somebody else to tears? Is there anybody here that can't say that they do that and still do that? And you know what? We need to love ourselves as much, too, that we don't criticize ourselves and judge ourselves unworthy. And that happens so often in life, I think. And we don't harm others by neglect. You know, we don't deny people medical or physical care or medication, or we don't deny them access to food or to heating or privacy or glory, but we do. How many people in the winter don't have heat? How many people don't have food at times? And how many people can't afford to get their prescriptions? We play a part in that, don't we? A systematic evil like that. We also harm people, I think, when we are a workaholic and we neglect our families. So we can do that by neglect as well, you know. It could also be spending money on maybe gambling or alcohol or drugs or just buying everything that you see more, more, more. That takes away from what our family really needs. And you know, to me, it's not giving back to God financially what we're capable of doing. That's neglect. Neglect of what's at the source of our strength. And then there's environmental harm. We know, usually you want to blame that on everybody else, right? It's the emissions that are going out and everything else, but are we really recycling at home? Are we still using those plastic bags? And no, don't look in our kitchen. Are we turning off lights when we're not using them and turning the air conditioner up when we're not using it? Because you see, doing harm is absolutely self-centered. We don't think about it that way because we think of things in terms of what's good for me. We don't usually think about it in terms of what's good for everybody else. And most of the time, we're not even aware of how much harm that we really do. Sometimes, for example, we'll participate in gossip and not even think about it as being gossip, right? So John Wesley would say then that we need to decide to do no harm first before we even begin to tackle good. So there is a piece of paper in your bulletin today. Do you see it? Everybody have one? And I'm going to just take a few minutes, and I want you to think about what are the three things that you will never do. I'm going to add again, because you can't write down, I'm not going to rob a bank, and I'm not going to kill somebody else, because that's not where most of our harm happens. Now, what you might do is say, I'm going to quit saying things about other people that kill their spirit. That would be an important thing. So we're going to be quiet for a few minutes, and I want you to fill out the three things that you promise to do no harm. How will you begin today to not hurt somebody else? Let's just take a few minutes.